How far would you go to protect your family? That's the overarching question in the new novel, The Dinner, by Dutch writer Herman Koch. Although the book only recently hit shelves in American stores, The Dinner has been on international bestseller lists since 2009. It's a suspense novel laced with compelling twists, a disturbing storyline, and a surprising ending, which we won't reveal. All that in a story that unfolds entirely over dinner. Steve Inskeep spoke with Herman Koch about The Dinner.
Congratulations on the novel.
Thank you.
Let me say in the best possible way, it made me sick.
Really? Yeah, okay.
Well, I'm a parent, so, you know, you get into these issues. I assume that's what you intended, right? I mean, you're going into some really, really personal, really edgy stuff here, aren't you?
Yes, I am. And it's, of course, I must explain that I'm a parent myself. So the idea more or less came from there, just to... feeling of what you would do to defend your children. But even in a very extreme case like is put forward in this novel.
In this case, and we don't want to give away too much, but it's been said in reviews, and you find within a few chapters that you have two sets of parents. They meet over dinner. They're discussing their sons, who appear to have videotaped themselves and been caught on security videotape doing something awful.
You're right.
And they discuss this all over dinner.
Yes, they do. They go to this kind of luxury restaurant, but it's with organic food. And the clientele is very much politicians, artists, football players.
And all along the way, you're learning what you imagine to be their values. They're talking about Sidney Poitier and guess who's coming to dinner. They're talking about various gradations of racism. They're thinking in some surface way about being parents and what's important to them.
Yes, and of course we learn most of the point of views also of the others from Paul, one of the fathers, who's telling the whole story in first person. And we don't know in the beginning what he is like. Maybe we might even sympathize with him up to a point. But then suddenly not only his opinions, but maybe his actions are becoming more extreme. So we might start to doubt if the version he gives of what the other three adults at the table are telling us or how they are is really the true story.
Oh, that did happen to me as a reader. At the beginning, you think this is a very normal guy surrounded by grotesque people.
Yeah, I thought so as well. When I started to write, I thought the same thing. This really occurred to me during the process of writing this novel. And it's only in the first sentence of the book that you learn something about the character when he says, we were going out to dinner, and I won't say which restaurant, because next time it might be full of people who've come to see whether we're there. So he's already hiding something.
So he is, on the surface, a normal guy. Everybody else in Paul's telling seems grotesque. We gradually learn that maybe it's his perception that is warped. And on top of that, he's a parent. He's a parent of a teenaged son.
Yeah.
And he minutely observes himself. You describe a man who's trying really hard to transmit a certain set of values to his son.
Yes. And, of course, this might not be the right set of values, but he actually believes that his values are right. He believes in happiness. He believes in the happy marriage that he has and his happy family. And he wants to defend this family against all outside forces, whether this is the police or psychologists or social workers. They won't come in. I was actually sometimes thinking when I wrote this book, in a series like The Sopranos, where something like this is also happening. You can feel sympathy for Tony Soprano, how he's behaving in his family life, but you know that his set of values is in general different from our set of values.
This is something that I suspect that parents can relate to, or at least understand the circumstance. You have someone who is your blood relation, who is your son or daughter, who beyond doubt has done something truly horrible. And the question comes up, what do you do?
What do you do? Yeah. And that was, of course, the question I asked myself. But anyway, I started out this way thinking, well, you would do everything for your child. No, you would organ transplantation, and in the end, you would even maybe give your life.
You also portray this narrator, Paul, as being a guy who, even as he seems to be inching toward the notion of overlooking a horrible crime, trying so hard to give his son some space. There are many discussions about privacy. There's a minutely described moment where he is sitting near his son while the son, very young, is sending text messages or something online. Yeah. And the father not only doesn't look, but tries to sit in such a way that the son has no suspicion that the father would ever even dream of looking. He's thinking about even his body language.
Yeah, that's me.
Is it really?
Yeah, I think so. But I think in one way or another, every parent is curious what their children, certainly young adult children, adolescents, you know, what are they doing when we don't see what they're doing? So from, you know, like 14-year-old until 18-year-old, this is the age where they go out and we don't see them all the time. They're not all the time in our home or at school. And then you think, what double lives are they leading? Is there something else? And then you get this dilemma when you think there's a mobile phone now here on the table. He left it at home. Will I look?
How old are your kids and how many?
I have one son and he's now 18. And when I started to write the book, he was only 11.
And you end up writing here about a father, that's the narrator, and his teenage son, who's kind of in the middle teenage years, as I recall.
Yeah, so 15 or 16 years old, yeah.
Has your son read this book?
Well, I must admit that he's not a big reader, and that includes mine. But I respect it because I think he has to keep some distance of this father.
Because this book has been out for a while before coming to the United States, there's room to ask this question. As you have heard people's responses to the book, has it turned out to be sort of like a Rorschach test? Different people see different things in it.
Yeah, I'm sure. It goes from people saying, well, this seemed a nice man in the beginning, but in the end, he is not, to put it mildly. And there's another part of the readers who say, finally, a character in a book who actually does what we are all thinking.
Mm.
This is the other extreme. Sometimes I notice that in southern countries, they see it more like a social criticism. And in Holland and in northern countries, they see it more as the storyline or the actual question of how far would you go to protect the ones you love.
The novel is The Dinner. The author is Hermann Koch. Thanks very much.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
You can read and hear an excerpt from The Dinner at npr.org. This is NPR News.
So I'm going to go out on a limb and say that for most families, weekday mornings can be a fairly stressful time. Here's a peek into my morning routine. So this is our morning. It's about 7:20 in the morning. The baby's in a pretty good mood, but he has a bad cold, and I need to find something to wipe his nose with. Oh, okay, that didn't go very well. And while it's hard for me as a mother of a 7-month-old to imagine, things only get more complicated when the kids get older. Our producer, Peter Breslow, has twin 13-year-old daughters, and here's a typical morning in their household.
I can't find my other shoe, and I need to make my lunch. It's 7:37.
Managing the chaos of family life is just one of the topics that author Bruce Feiler tackles. In his new book, it's called The Secrets of Happy Families. Feiler himself is the father of twins, and when he went looking for parenting guidance, he says there weren't a lot of options.
Parents are in this straitjacket almost, that the only ideas we can implement in our homes have to come from what I call the family improvement industry, right? Shrinks and self-help gurus and family experts. And to be honest, I found their ideas stale. I kept hearing the same things over and over again.
So to get some new ideas, Feiler looked in some unexpected places.
I was having dinner. It was New Year's Eve, and I was with a group of friends, and I was sitting next to an executive at Silicon Valley, and I said, tell me what's going on in your world that might be able to help my family. And she told me about this program that she was running at her company, and that program is called Agile, and it's an idea that things should not become top-down. They should be done in small groups, and you should get constant feedback and change all the time and adapt. You know, our instinct as parents is to boss our kids around, because it's easier and because we're usually right. But as any parent knows, if you tell the same kid to do the same thing over and over again, it doesn't work. And what, you know, what this system does is build in change so you can react to what's going on in real time.
So the cornerstone of this idea of an agile family movement, and there is such a thing now, the cornerstone is this idea of the family meeting. How did this go down when you told your family that you were going to start having these?
My wife was skeptical at first, but she also, as she says, was so desperate for ideas, she was willing to try. And then what happened was our girls, we started when they are 5. They're almost 8 now, so we've been doing it for 3 years weekly. They really embraced it. And what was interesting about it was, first of all, the most amazing things started coming out of their mouths, right? So what worked well this week? Getting over our fears of riding a bike or making our beds. What didn't go well? You know, our math sheets or greeting visitors at the door. You know, like a lot of parents, Rachel, we thought our children were like Bermuda Triangles, you know, like ideas would go in, but they would never come out. This meeting gave us kind of access to their innermost thoughts. You know, think about it, Rachel. We have our jobs. We work on those. We have our hobbies. We work on those. We have our bodies. We work on those. The family is so central to our lives. And the truth is, very few of us actually work on that.
Another idea that you gleaned from someone who works in corporate America is the idea of drafting a family mission statement, which is really interesting. You would think, you know, that feels kind of corporate. How does this work for a family?
I would say this is one of the top 2 or 3 things that I most enjoyed and that our family most benefited from. And it comes out of, again, of a core problem. Every parent I know struggles with this idea of how do I teach my kids values, right? How do I say even in a 24/7 world, some things are timeless? And then I realized, you know, have I really told my children? I mean, I could sit down and ask my kids, you know, what's really important to your parents? But have I really made the trouble to tell them? So we did the family equivalent of a corporate retreat. We had a pajama party. And we had this chart and we had this conversation like, what's really important to us? What sayings that mom and dad use all the time do you most remember? And what is it that we most want to stand for? And it can't be what you want to stand for. It has to be actually what you do. You know, honesty. Yeah, honesty is important, but come on, is that really a core value for us? You know, you can't just wag your finger. And we ended up with this list. And you know, there's a lot of research that shows that if you identify what is your best possible self, you know, if you identify what it is that you aspire to, you're going to do a better job of trying to achieve that. So our family mission statement is, may our first word be adventure and our last word, love.
There are lots of provocative ideas in the book. One that many listeners out there may find liberating. You say, rethink the family dinner and maybe give it up entirely. How come?
It is like the big bogeyman in families today. Like everybody has heard that family dinner is great for kids. But unfortunately, it doesn't work in many of our lives. Well, guess what? Dig deeper into the research and it's very interesting. It turns out there's only 10 minutes of productive conversation in any family dinner. 10 minutes. The rest is taken up with take your elbows off the table and pass the ketchup. I mean, maybe my favorite idea in the whole book came out of this process of looking into family dinner. Researchers at Emory gave children a do you know test. Do you know where your grandparents were born? Do you know where your parents went to high school? Do you know any member of your family who had an illness or something terrible that happened to them that they overcame? Children who scored highest on the do you know test had higher self-esteem and a greater sense of control over their lives. If you tell your own story to your children, that includes your positive moments and the negative moments and how you overcame them, you give your children the skills and the confidence they need to feel like they can overcome some hardship that they face.
And it's okay to have those conversations perhaps in 10-minute increments at night or in the morning or whenever you can sneak them in.
You can do it in the morning. You can do it at carpool. You can do it snuggling in bed at night. You don't need a grand plan. You need to take small steps. You need to accumulate small wins. In the end, to me, this is the greatest lesson of all.
Bruce Feiler, his new book is called The Secrets of Happy Families. He talked to us from our New York bureau. Bruce, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So what are your tips for a happy family? What have you tried that worked or didn't work? Let us know on our Facebook page, NPR Weekend, or you can tweet me at @RachelNPR.
And if you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden, and it's time now for music. Yoko Ono celebrates her birthday tomorrow. She'll be 80 years old. Yoko Ono and John Lennon had perhaps one of the most torrid love affairs in rock and roll history. Inseparable after Lennon dropped in on her conceptual art show in New York in 1968, the two would marry, have a son together, and become co-creators in music, art, and activism. Writer Jonathan Cott met them in the early days of the romance when he was working on a piece for Rolling Stone magazine. Lennon, 27, was in the middle of recording his new album with the Beatles, The White Album. To Cott's astonishment, Lennon invited him to the Abbey Road sessions.
Like as if he said to me, why don't you come along the Magical Mystery Tour or something, or going to the Yellow Submarine with him and the Beatles, you know. So I went up and I walked in there and, you know, crossed that zebra pattern.
Crossed the zebra crossing in London.
Which was holy ground. And as soon as the other Beatles saw me, they just really cringed. They didn't care for this at all. They hadn't been informed that he was bringing someone. And I just hid behind one of the speakers and I stayed there for a number of hours listening to them work on these two songs. One was Helter Skelter.
When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride. Till I get to the bottom and I see you again. Yeah, yeah.
Which was Paul McCartney's song, which really is a proto-heavy metal song. And very uncharacteristic of Paul McCartney, just totally insane sounding, crazy, end of the world thing. And then John Lennon was doing Glass Onion.
I told you about Strawberry Fields. You know the place where nothing is real. Well, here's another place you can go. Where everything flows.
Which was gentle and kind of stream of consciousness, Beatles mythology, images of Fool on the Hill and Lady Madonna's and Strawberry Fields.
Do you, don't you want me to love you?
The heavy metal stuff was really like, drove me out of my mind. They were repeating it over and over and editing and remixing and all that and rehearsing. And then the Glass Onion song came and it was just so dreamy. So it was really like having the marriage of heaven and hell.
Yoko Ono would change John Lennon's life. And in your book, he's talking to a friend and he said, you know, the minute I met this woman, it was as if I had known her before in another lifetime. My life was complete. I want to spend every day of my life with her. You found that a very natural process between the two of them. What did John Lennon tell you?
Well, you know, their first date, she went over to his home and he had a music studio on the top floor. And he said, why don't we go up and make a recording, you know? So they went up at midnight, and they made this recording. It was kind of a John Cage-like sound montage, and he was playing piano, organ, and percussion, and she was singing, and he had was fooling around with sound effects like reverb and backward tapes and white noise and all that. And they played all night, and then they made love at dawn. And, you know, from that moment on, this was not going to be a one-night stand. This one-night stand lasted until 1973, when they separated for 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And they were never out of each other's sights for all those years. You know, he had a line in one of his songs which go, when we're together or when we're apart, there's never a space in between the beat of our hearts. I mean, how romantic can you get?
When we're together.
She was his soul guide and teacher, life teacher and best friend. Their relationship was really 50-50.
In the book, Jonathan, you emphasize that she had a really positive influence on his personality, despite this rupture in 1973. How would you say that was manifested?
You know, when they were together, let me answer it this way, if it's all right. They were so attuned to each other as if they were finishing each other's sentences. Let me give an example. She would write one of her songs, I said yes, I prayed yes, a thousand times yes.
I said yes, I said yes, I said yes. I prayed a thousand times yes.
And he would write, yes is the answer, and you know that for sure, yes is surrender, you've got to let it go.
Yes.
Then she would say, touch, 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 just one touch, that's all I need, something like that. And he'd write a song in which he had the words, touch is love, love is touch.
Love is touch. Touch is love.
Then she'd have an instruction in her book, Grateful, which is a book of instruction poems and pieces. And she would say, imagine the clouds dripping. And then he would write, imagine there's no heaven.
Imagine there's no heaven.
And they had this kind of a strange symbiotic connection, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
They were just attuned to each other. I mean, John Lennon called their relationship Two Minds, One Destiny.
My guest is writer Jonathan Cott. His new book is called Days That I'll Remember, Spending Time with John Lennon and Yoko Ono. You saw John Lennon just a few days before he was murdered. It had to be staggering to learn what had happened.
For everybody. But I was there December 5th, and I was there for 9 hours at his home and then into the recording studio where they were making Yoko Ono's record, very famous record as it turned out, called Walking on Thin Ice.
Walking on thin ice, I'm paying the price.
2 nights later, on the 8th, the night of December 8th, he was actually carrying a cassette tape that contained the final mix for that song when he went home and just before he was killed. So, in fact, what's so fascinating to me is that their first date was a musical collaboration, and their last date, so to speak, was also a musical collaboration. And if I could just quote the last lines from Walking on Thin Ice, they go, I may cry someday, but the tears will dry whichever way, and when our hearts return to ashes, it'll be just a story, it'll be just a story. Can you imagine writing that song? Those lyrics, and then what happened a half hour later?
It's just the most incredible foreshadowing.
I may cry someday, but the tears will dry whichever way.
As you think about this extraordinary person who was only 40 years old when he died, of all the memories that you've amassed, you know, what stands out?
Well, that's a really good question. The fact that he asked me to go to a Beatles recording session and had no qualms about doing it and just saying, come on, it's going to be okay. And that's what he also said to me when I sat down to do my first interview with him, because I was really nervous. And he said, there's nothing to be nervous about. Come on, and, you know, it's going to be okay, and we're doing it together, and that's what really matters.
And in your last interview, didn't he also say, you've got loads of time?
Yeah, he said, I was saying, oh, I just heard the album, but I didn't have enough time to really listen to it deeply, and I don't know. Then he just interrupted me and said, look, slow down. We got plenty and plenty of time, plenty of time.
When I was younger, living confusion, deep despair.
That's writer Jonathan Cott. He's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone, and his new book is called Days That I'll Remember, Spending Time with John Lennon and Yoko Ono, and it's out now. Jonathan Cott, thank you very much for being here and talking with us.
And thank you. It really was nice to be here.
Our program is directed today by Lily Percy. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Amy Held, Liz Baker, Becky Hersher, and Acacia Squires. Our interns are Annie Russell and Rachel Rood. Our weekend web producers are Melissa Goh, Stephanie Federico, Krishnadev Cullimore, and Dana Farrington. The technical director is Rob Berman. At the operations desk, Tom Woodward. Our reference librarian is Kima Leski. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is the senior producer. And for Sunday, that's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. Check out our podcast. Find it at npr.org/weekendatc or on the NPR smartphone app. It's called Weekends on All Things Considered, or you can follow me on Twitter at NPR Jackie Lydon. We're back on the radio next weekend. Until then, thank you for listening and have a great week.
Michael Haney was 6 years old when his Uncle Dick came to their home one morning to tell Michael and his brother that their father was dead. Bob Haney was just 35. He was the slot man, a high-pressure, high-profile position overnight on the Chicago Sun-Times, a newspaper that in 1970 was the quintessence of roustabout Chicago journalism. Bob Haney had died of a heart attack on a North Side street, as one of the obits put it, while visiting friends. Over the years, Michael Haney grew up to be a journalist himself. He's now the deputy editor of GQ. Began to wonder about some of the small differences in the obits between newspapers and about some of the obliqueness in the accounts of his father's death that he grew up hearing from his uncle and mother. So we set out to find out the story himself. His new book, After Visiting Friends, A Son's Story. And Michael Haney joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Nice to be here, Scott.
You were six. Mm-hmm. When did you begin to wonder about that phrase, after visiting friends?
I think when I first discovered those obituaries, I was in high school, you know, 17 years old, working on a term paper. And I was in the public library in town, and I just, on a whim, thought, I'd never seen these obits, and I went looking for them. And there those phrases were, but at the time I was too afraid to discuss anything with my mother. But they were like that thing that's way down in the basement that you hear rattling and you hear it at night when you're in bed and you just keep trying to push it down and not think about it, but it just keeps rattling around and you've got to go down and look at it.
When did you begin to suspect it was some kind of euphemism after visiting friends?
Probably about 10, 12 years ago. And the question to me was, how come at the funeral I never met any of these friends, and none of these friends ever came forward and said, I was with your father the night he died, and it was a terrible thing. But I want you to know he didn't suffer, or, you know, he thought of you. I mean, no one ever came forward, and I thought, things just don't add up, and you start to wonder about why don't they add up.
You depict what's often considered a kind of modern golden age of, of Chicago journalism. There was great, vivid writers and personalities. And
right.
I'll rattle off the names: Mike Royko, Tom Fitzpatrick, Roger Ebert, the early Bob Green, Jim Hoag, the Golden Boy editor, and if I may, great watering holes like the Billy Goat and Ricardo's. In the end, was it so golden?
I think for them it was a golden time, and it was, you know, a time I really wanted to sort of pay homage to that period. You know, as I say in the book, it was this wonderful moment between the front page era and the information age. You know, one of the epigrams in the book is from this guy named Uli Uhlenberg, who coins the great Chicago phrase for all Chicago newspapermen, which is, if your mother says she loves you, check it out.
At the same time, a lot of those memories are kind of in a, if I may, an alcoholic fog, too.
A little amber. I think, you know, my father worked what was called the lobster shift. It was 6 p.m. to 2 a.m. Yeah. You know, he slept during the day. We'd have breakfast with him in the morning, and these guys would sort of like, you know, at 6 o'clock, and as one of them said, they would take their lunch at 10 p.m., go out to a bar across the street and drink. Every newspaper had its own bar, whether it's the Tribune, the Sun-Times, the Daily News, the Chicago Today, they all had their own.
And there were five dailies in Chicago in those times.
Including the Defender. So they all had their dedicated bars, and these guys all just circulated amongst them.
Spoiler alert, visiting friends turned out to be a euphemism for visiting a woman.
Yes.
The person's apartment persuaded them to call. His visiting friends turned out to be a euphemism for visiting a woman.
Yes.
The person's apartment persuaded them to call his brother.
Yes.
Not your mother.
Right.
Why tell your mother?
You know, once I found out what happened, I sat on that for a good 1 or 2 years. I had this great fear that if I find something out and I tell my mother, I could lose her love and lose my brother's love and be cast out. And yet, inside, this thing I feared was a truth. And that truth, once I put it out for my mother and brother, it actually answered questions for her that were 40 years old. It brought all of us closer, and I think it brought a new life to our family.
Another tough question.
Mm-hmm.
For those of us who lose a father when we're kids, I recommend a play by Robert Anderson called I Never Sang for My Father.
Mm-hmm.
There's a line in there that goes, death ends a life, but it doesn't end a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Your father has been gone for some time now, but I know the relationship goes on.
Mm-hmm.
So your father had a secret.
Mm-hmm.
He had a secret relationship, if not a secret love, and maybe both. Why not keep his secret? I mean, just because he's dead, does he lose the right to keep a few secrets?
That is, boy, that's a good question. You know, he's been dead 40 years, more than 40 years now, and you cite that line, which makes me think of a line that I wrote in my book, which is, you know, our absence is greater than our presence. And whether you've lost a father or a mother or a sibling, through death or just someone's drifted out of your life or you've lost, we all wonder, what happened to them? Why did you leave me? What became of this? It is his story, you're right, but it, as fathers and sons and daughters and fathers and daughters and mothers, we're all inextricably entwined. And I think this is my story as well as his story. So, I mean, you know, someone asked me after I learned the truth about my father that night, what had happened. They said, well, how do you feel about him now? And I said, you know, I had finally, you know, 40 years later, and here I am, a man almost 50, and I see him now no longer as son to father, little boy to man. But I finally, in that moment, I saw him as man to man, someone I could sit side by side with at the bar and have those conversations with that I never was able to.
Michael Haney, deputy editor of GQ and author of the new book, At Visiting Friends, A Son's Story. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Karen Russell's first novel, Swamplandia, made a splash when it was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. Russell's latest book is a collection of short stories called Vampires in the Lemon Grove. Meg Wolitzer has this review.
Karen Russell's writing is original. I know you're thinking, oh, come on, Meg. Calling a writer original is like saying a book was 20% off at Barnes & Noble. But in this case, it's true. In one story, a group of dead presidents are reincarnated as horses. One of them tries to talk to a girl by licking her palm in a secret code. He is Rutherford Burchard Hayes, the 19th president of the United States of America, he says. She should alert the local officials. But the girl just laughs. That tickles. This is why I love Karen Russell. All the stories are premised on these really bizarre, complex ideas. It makes you wonder if other writers out there have this kind of imagination and they don't tap into it because they're afraid no one will know what they're talking about. Maybe she's just the only one who is brave enough not to worry about that. In another story, two vampires are living in a lemon grove in Italy. They've realized that if they bite lemons, they get a little relief from their constant bloodlust. But it never really goes away. It's an existential thing. Another theme that keeps coming up in this collection is the idea of transformation. People could change at any minute, and worse, they, or maybe we, could become disgusting or violent or embarrassing. One story is called Reeling for the Empire. It's about these girls who are trapped in a silk factory, and they start to turn into the silkworms. The vampires in the lemon grove have to adapt over time in order to survive. In the barn at the end of our term, which is the one about the dead presidents, even the most establishy establishment figures aren't safe. They all have this kind of terrible helplessness. And then there's my favorite story, The Graveless Doll of Eric Mutis. It also has a transformation, but it's more subtle. It's about a group of boys who are bullies. Their prey is Eric Mutis, and the narrator explains that they beat him up in part because of his sneakers. At school, we made a point of stealing hoops from any kid stupid enough to wear them. Hoops were imitation Nikes, he says. The H logo was a flamboyant way to announce to your class, hey, I'm poor. He disappears and no one notices. Then the boys find a scarecrow tied to a tree, and they realize it looks just like Eric Mutis. But could it literally be him? Karen Russell leaves a lot of ambiguity in her work, and it's not always easy to tell what the facts are. But what's clear in this story is the atmosphere. The boys are terrified, and the reader is too, and that's the product of a skillful writer. In Karen Russell's collection, horses are presidents, vampires suck lemons, and scarecrows are people. I finished it feeling transformed myself. I'm not a monster, at least not yet, but after reading this collection, I'm a fan.
The short story collection is called Vampires in the Lemon Grove, written by Karen Russell. Her newest fan is reviewer Meg Wolitzer. Wolitzer's next novel, out soon, is called The Interestings. And for our younger listeners who love to read, a backseat book club reminder, keep reading OK for Now by Gary Schmidt, and then send in your comments or questions to backseatbookclub@npr.org, and stay tuned for our conversation.